In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, hello and welcome to Pure Home. It's our first program in the new Iranian year, so a very warm welcome to our New Year's Pure Home. Well, it's the new year and you're all familiar with the topic of New Year resolutions. We all make decisions to do in the new year, like we decide to lose weight, we decide to be a better person, we decide to start working out, we decide to make new friends, we decide to be happier. But how much do we really fulfill these decisions, or we just make them because we're happy, we're excited, and it's the new season, it's the new time of year? Please join me and my guest today, Dr. Fatemi, to discuss this subject in more detail. Hello, Dr. Fatemi. Welcome to Pure Home in the new year. Thanks for being with us. Dr. Sayed Mohsen Fatemi has done his postdoctoral studies in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. He teaches in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University and Western Washington University. He is a frequently published author and a poet and has been the keynote speaker of a number of international conferences. He is also a licensed and registered psychologist and has taught at other institutions, including the University of British Columbia, the University of Toronto, a Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, the University of Massachusetts in Boston, University of Phoenix, Harvard, and Western Washington Universities. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Fatemi, in our first Pure Home program in the new year. Let me start by asking you that as we experience the new year, the new season, and the new beginning, what types of implications does the new year have for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'd like to first extend my felicitations and congratulations to you and the audience on the occasion of the new year. And I hope that the new year be brimmed with novel moments of joy, composure, and peace. It's a good question in the new year to begin with. The new year coincides with new developments, new changes. It resonates with everybody. The tintinnabulation of a new orchestra, a new possibility, a new vision, a new horizon. And as a result of that, people get that sense of experiencing the new year in its phenomenological sense, associated with the fragrance of new possibilities, the domain of new horizons. When people hear the new year's concept of emergence, they have this sort of association of ideas that the new year is going to echo with them the new possibilities. So everybody is going to think about building something new, starting everything afresh, making up new things in his or her mind. And as a result of that, the new year always constantly implies that it is bountiful, it is opulently rich in terms of possibilities. It is always resonating with the possibility of new horizons. And new avenues of possibilities are going to be emerging for people. Ipso facto, the new year has got this abode of creational capabilities, so people can take upon themselves to create new decisions, to come up with new understanding of the world, to come up with new realization of their interaction between themselves and people around themselves. So when we think of the new year, it's always associating with revitalization, resuscitation, the concept of you know, liveliness, vivacity, the concept of experiencing everything afresh.
Yeah, so we like to think that maybe we made mistakes in the past year. We now get a new opportunity, a new lease of life to maybe make up for what we've lost in the past year. Or has it also got to do with, in Iran, it also coincides with the start of a new season, spring. Does that also count? And I mean, that also contributes to our feeling of wanting to rejuvenate ourselves?
Surely it does, because, you know, spring itself is associated with, you know, fresh fragrance and redolence. You just go and walk down the street and you've got these cynosures of fragrance and lilacs are all around you. Flowers are blooming, flourishing, blossoming up. And as a result of that, you just walk down the wild meadows of your own reflective imagination as you experience this sort of possibility. So spring is going to be the commencement of the new year. But in the meantime, our poets, our scholars, our Islamic erudites have always reiterated, as we have in Quran, that Prophet Muhammad salawatullah alayhi said, whenever you come across the spring and you bump into all these cynosures and everything, just remember the day of judgment, the day of resurrection. Yes. Because the spring is giving you this possibility that as everything is going to be starting afresh, and the whole thing about autumn and the cold winter, all those nights of you know, desperation, so to speak,
long,
are gone. You know, long dark nights, despondency and despair are going to go away. And as a result of that, hope is going to emerge. So spring is the commencement, is the preamble of being hopeful about yourself, being hopeful about God's grace and compassion. And Rumi has got a beautiful allusion to it, which he says, you can have always spring and autumn inside yourself. The difference is that the autumn and the fall in the real world, it takes a long time, relatively, yes, to get changed and develop and transform, but a spring can just happen in twinkling of an eye. You can, you know, before you can say Jack Robinson, spring can, you know, can happen and unfold itself. And the good thing is that a spring is also the manifestation of a radical transformation of consciousness. People can transform, not only in forms, as we have in the prayer right at the beginning of the new year. You always have had this prayer that we appeal to God Almighty to help us, you know, transform our hearts, you know, transform our feelings. And we appeal to God, who is the owner, who is the quintessentially present in every layer of our life, to have that omnipotence affect us and get that sense of compassion, that sense of compassion for us.
Yes.
As a result of that, we are going to be affected by that sense of transformational aspect. So the new year helps everybody, provides everybody with new possibility of radically transforming himself or herself.
That's
all, you know, through all these ups and downs that we've experienced, and now we've got this great chance to create new possibilities. We're not doomed for failure for the autumn. We can always begin, and the spring is going to have possibilities for everybody.
Of course. Thank you so much for that. We're not done talking to Dr. Fatemi yet. Let's go listen to today's story. We'll be back and talk more about this interesting subject.
The Servant's Shoe. Once upon a time, there was a party in which some masters and their servants were invited. The masters talked to each other, and the servants listened quietly. Each master talked about the advantages of his own life. One of them said, "The best thing in life is to have a good and hard-working servant." Another said, "How is your servant?" He is very clever, agile, and hardworking. During all the years that he has worked for me, he has never been lazy. Impossible. I myself have been lazy sometimes. How is it possible that a servant has never been lazy? The master patted on his servant's back and said, "Go to the bazaar right now and buy some salt from the grocery store." The servant stood up and went out. The master said, "Now you will see what he does. I will tell you where he is now and when he'll be back. He left the house right now. He is walking quickly. Now he has reached a square. He passes the square. Now he is at the bazaar. The bazaar is crowded. He goes from places where are less crowded. Now he is near the grocery store. He stands there for a while to get his breath. He says hello and asks for the salt. Now he is taking the salt and paying the price. Now he's coming back. He runs so that he will be back here sooner. Now be quiet and listen. You will hear him knock the door in a moment." Everybody kept quiet. A knock on the door was heard. Everybody said, "Well done." The servant came in and sat next to his master. At this time, another master told his servant, "You should be like this one too." "I can, if you want me to do so." The next day, there was a party again. Everyone talked about his business and his life. Meanwhile, a master said, "Now that you are talking about the positive characteristics of your servants, I want to do it too." A person asked, "What special abilities does he have?" "He is as quick as a wink." "How?" "I'll send him to bazaar right now to convey my regards to Shams, the cobbler. Let's see how quickly he'll be back." Then he looked at the servant and said, "Tell Shams to cobble my shoes however he likes." The servant stood up and left the room. The master told the details of his journey, just as the other master had said the day before. Then he said happily, "Now you will see where my servant is now. He must be at the door right now." "Where are you, servant?" The servant, who was near the door, said, "I'm here, master. Did you deliver my message to the cobbler?" "The message? No, I haven't left the house yet." "What are you saying? What have you been doing all this time?" "I was looking for my shoes, master. There are so many pairs of shoes here that I couldn't understand which one of them is mine. It is as if all the shoes of the world were here." The master, who was pale due to feeling ashamed, said, "You stupid. Haven't you left the house yet? Are you still searching among the shoes?"
Welcome back. Let's continue our discussion with Dr. Fatemi. Let's move on to New Year resolutions. As I talked in the beginning of the program, that I think it's quite a familiar topic to many of our viewers. I don't think there are a few of us who don't make new resolutions, like deciding to lose weight as the like the most basic one, maybe I could say, deciding to look better, deciding to start working out, being happier, and the list just goes on. But we often don't carry on with them. They fail. Maybe we start them, but we never carry through. What's the reason? Is it just because we're happy, we say something, we make a decision? And would you tell us more about this? And
sure.
Why these resolutions fail?
Yeah, major decisions to bring major changes often fail. The reason for that, from a psychological perspective, is that when you make major decisions, you somehow get yourself committed to a large array of options. And these choices or options are going to be too much for you. To exemplify this, I'll just give you a simple example. If you have not been used to reading books, for example, and tonight you decide to finish a chapter, you won't be able to do it because the first and the second page are going to be fine. Then you see yourself overwhelmed. Oh, you got to have all these all these pages wrapped up by the end of 10 o'clock p.m. or something. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be like an encumbrance. It's going to be like something that is intolerable. It is unbearable. It seems like a seemingly insurmountable obstacle. It seems like a seemingly insurmountable impediment. And as a result of that, people, when they make major decisions to bring major changes, they get themselves exposed to all these sort of hard commitments, sense of challenging encumbrances, which are going to be imposing. But if you make minor decisions to bring minor changes in your life, it's going to be smooth and it's going to facilitate the process. The reason for that is that if you just say to yourself, well, I'm going to start, for example, tonight with 2 pages, and then tomorrow you're going to have 3 pages. Or if you want to stop smoking, for example, and if you're a chain smoker, you can't just say, well, I'm going to stop smoking, I'm going to quit smoking, and everything is going to be forsaken for good. Yeah. But if you say, well, you know, I feel like smoking now, instead of 2, I'm going to go with 1, and then tomorrow you're going to just have it to half and half. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be facilitating the process. When people bring major decisions to bring major changes, the other thing that happens to them is that they try to detach themselves from the rudimentary hackneyed layers of their previously established habits quickly. And habits are like soft beds. It's so easy to get into them, but it's hard to get out of them. And if you just want to stop habits or something, you can't do it right away. I mean, you have to just give yourself time and possibility to facilitate that process. So instead of going for major decisions to bring major changes, what you can do is that you can begin with stage number 1, make a decision, find out what is it that you want to do, envision the possibility of the decision. And the second is that always begin with small stages, small changes, small sort of steps, and think about the implications. What is going to happen if I go with decision? Visualization, according to research, has been proven effective implications for developing minor decisions to bring minor changes. Specifically, when you visualize, you just see yourself benefiting from the sagacity of that decision, and that decision has got implications. So you see yourself somehow shrouded by the habits on the one hand, and then you come and you want to take it upon yourself to go ahead with the new changes, which is going to be fine, but it is going to be like a hard road to hoe. It's a Herculean task because it is going to be imposing right at the beginning. You just want to break the old pattern that has been imposing so far. Yep. So if you've had, for example, whatever habits you may think of for the past 20 years, for the past 10 years, for the past even
it's
2 years.
It's harder to break them.
You know, and you just want to go ahead and break it. It is going to be imposing, and that sort of imposing predilection is going to develop some sort of negative implications for you. But if you say, well, I'm going to go with minor changes, minor decisions for minor changes, you get a better sense of commitments. You start your homework with stage number 1, then you go to B, and it's taking
to you. It's actually better to take baby steps instead of.
Yeah, that's why they call it baby step in a lot of psychological homework.
Yes.
It just it facilitates the process in a more effective manner.
Yes, that's so true. But speaking like about myself, I feel like when I'm happy and excited at any time, especially a time like the New Year, I'm more likely to think of resolutions because I'm happy at that moment. But when that happiness wears off, then I say, well, I'm not so sure. Well, I said it, but I don't feel like it. I think that happens to many of us, that we make resolutions or decisions at a time when, or even commitments. We tell someone that we'll do that, we'll do something for them. Because we're excited, we're feeling good at that moment. But when that good feeling, when that happiness and excitement wears off, we just feel like, oh, we don't feel like doing it. What can we do? Is it normal, or what can
we
do about
it? I'm glad that you brought up this because as you brought this up, it helps us understand another psychological mechanism within decision-making process, and that is going to entail your psychological emotions, your affects, your sense of feelings which are going to be affecting the quality of your decision making. If you're in a bad mood, if you're out of sorts, if you're down in the dumps, if you feel despondence and you feel that sort of despair getting engulfed, you don't have that sort of feeling to go ahead with decision. So decisions always need to be induced, and decisions need to be unfolding themselves in a panoramic sense of beauty and good feelings. In other words, when people are placed in positive mood, when people are inducing consciously or unconsciously positive thoughts, when they are exposed to, instead of automatic negative thoughts, they are exposed to positive proactive thoughts, the chance of their making decision in a more effective manner goes up. The reason for that, according to a lot of psychological studies, goes to and emanates from the perspective that when you are involved in negative automatic thoughts, you cannot see anything except that sort of negative perspective that is having an impact on you. Whereas when you have positive thoughts, you have this broad perspective. You can just put this on trial yourself. When you're in a negative mood, you can't see anything except that negativity that is going to annoy you. But when you're in a positive mood, you just see this broad perspective. You can think of so many options, infinite possibilities. So it goes ad infinitum. And as a result of that, once you are placed in that sense of mood, you would be more apt and you would be more susceptible. You would have more sort of predilection. You would be more prone towards that possibility of making novel changes, making innovative changes. And that goes back to the discussion that we've had previously in this program, that if you are living in the moment as eagerly as possible, if you are getting connected to that exhilarating sense of being connected to the live moments of your life, you would have more effective, proactive decisions. But when people are so mindless, if they are established in a sense of negative perspective, they won't be able to get that sense of positive, proactive decisions because they just act from a single perspective. And as a result of that single perspective, they have this premature cognitive commitment which stops them from making a decision. So in order to prevent that sense of prochialism, that sense of circumscribing approach that is going to paralyze them, they need to just get that sense of exhilaration that is going to be liberating, it's going to be emancipating, it's going to get them off that box of negativity.
So are you saying we should try to, did I get this right, that we should try to learn to be, to sort of maintain a constant feeling of happiness and positivity so that when we make decisions, even at a time that we're happy, we can carry through with that?
We should learn to be mindful in the sense that we should learn to revamp whatever negativity is going to come and stops us from looking at the proactive thoughts, because most of our negative thoughts are automatic. They're automatic because they just come in a counterproductive sense and they impose themselves against us. But once we have that sense of proactive mindfulness, we say, well, I'm not going to be just subjected to the subjugation of the sovereignty of all these negative thoughts. I can always take it upon myself to revamp it. You know, it's like you're driving in a highway and you've got all these cars around you. Would you ever go and poke your nose into their affairs and say, why are you listening to this song or why are you wearing this? You never do that. You just let them go. So all these negative thoughts that are around you, mm-hmm. you can just have this flood of negative thoughts and they just come automatically. But once they come, you can be mindful and say, well, I'm not going to be subjected to them. I'm not going to be accepting their subjugation. I'm not going to accept their sovereignty. And as a result of that, I would have the possibility of revising, revamping, redeveloping new patterns of thoughts. And those new patterns of thoughts are going to give you that sense of exhilaration, that sense of euphoria. And that sense of exhilaration is going to provide you with new choices, because you can see that, oh, I have the choice to do the following because of this exhilaration. And that's why you pointed out that while you're in a positive mood, you're in a good mood, the chance of your decision making in a more proactive manner goes up. While you're in a negative mood, you just say, well, I won't have the time, I'm not going to do it, so you procrastinate. which is going to be the result of either overanalyzing or being subjected to all these negative thoughts. But once you get that exhilaration going on, flowing down the realm of your possibility, you would always have the possibility of, you know, making up new decisions with new form of exhilaration, new forms of happiness.
Okay, that was great. Thank you so much for that. Now, Bahman Nurai is here in the studio with Here and There. Let's go to Mr. Nurai and see what he's got for us today. Let's move right ahead to Mr. Nurai with Here and There. Mr. Nurai, what have you got for us today?
Thank you, Ms. Eganafan. Doctor, it's a pleasure to be here with you. I'm Bahman Nurai, and I have the pleasure of being here today and from now on taking over the Here and There part. All right. For the first news bit that I have for you today, how many of you have had trouble sleeping in days and nights? Because according to this study that I'm going to talk to you about, individuals with chronic sleep disruptions could face an earlier onset of the Alzheimer's disease. A study shows that as the researchers from Temple University in Philadelphia, PA, are having this problem as a start, the team focused on longitudinal studies that showed individuals who had been reported with chronic sleep problems often develop Alzheimer's. Sleep disturbances can be caused by a number of factors, including work, stress, insomnia, etc. I think you need to work a little bit more on your sleeping patterns, as it certainly improve your chances of actually not getting the Alzheimer's. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, insufficient sleep is as often associated with chronic conditions and diseases such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and depression. The big biological question that we tried to address in this study, according to Dr. Domenico Pratiku, professor of pharmacology and immunology in Temple School of Medicine, is that they tried to address in this study is whether sleep disturbance is a risk factor to develop Alzheimer's, or is it something that manifests with the disease. To further investigate, Mr. Pratiku and his team employed the use of a transgenic Alzheimer's mouse model, that is mice with DNA from humans, and when the researchers conducted memory tests on the mice, the group with reduced sleep time showed astonishingly significant impairment in their abilities and in their mental abilities. Thank you for that. Be with you in a bit. All right, moving on to cinema. This is my interest as well. Of course, Iranian feature film From Tehran to Heaven has been selected to represent Iran's cinema at two international film festivals in California, United States. Directed by Abolfaz Safari, the film is scheduled to be screened at the 28th festival in Washington, D.C., and then in California. 28th Washington, D.C. International Film Festival that will be held from April the 17th until April the 28th. From Tehran to Heaven will be vying with films from France, India, and Denmark, next to several other countries at the main competition section of the event. The movie will also be presented at the 13th annual Tiburon International Film Festival in California, which is to take place from April the 7th until April the 15th. The 75-minute film chronicles a pregnant woman's desperate search for her husband within a surreally disorganized city. The woman named Ghazal returns from a sonogram to find her husband Farad missing and the home ransacked. The film has been recently displayed at the 43rd Rotterdam International Film Festival in the Netherlands, and of course presented in the 2013 Sydney Intercultural Festival and the Montreal World Film Festival. Be you back in a bit with the book. Welcome back. Today I'm going to introduce you to the book Goal of Life, written by the late Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari. The book is a collection of five lectures delivered in 1972 on the subject Goal of Life as part of a series called World from an Islamic Perspective. This book contains five lectures, including The Goal of Creation, The Basis of Individual and Social Ethics, Faith, Schools of Thought and World Vision, Islamic Faith and Human Perfection, and finally, a sum up of Islamic monotheism. These lectures are closely connected in this way that they offer various ideas offered by various schools, and particularly Islam, concerning the goal of life and human perfection. I hope you enjoy reading this book. All right, back to Dr. Fatemi here. Doctor, I've been going through the emails and I found a really relevant email, actually. The question was really good. It could be a question for a lot of the viewers here. It says, we have heard many times that prayer and supplication can rehabilitate our soul and heart, but all the supplications in Islam are in Arabic. Is there any way, Doctor, that we could say them, the prayers, in another language? Thank you for your answer.
Sure, that's an interesting question. We need to take into consideration a number of points. One of them is that obviously you can always read the translation, and the translation is going to help you understand the profound layers of the text of supplication or prayer. But on the other hand, something that should not be concealed to oblivion comes from the fact that when you read something in Arabic, it has, in terms of locutionary perspective, to use the language of people who have got a command of syntax and grammar and those kind of things, the impact is way different from the plain form that has been translated. In other words, from the etymological perspective of the prayer and supplication, each word has got an impact. So when you read something in Arabic, the sound, the phonology, the semantics, the pragmatics, all of them, in terms of the paradigmatic analysis and in terms of the syntagmatic analysis, they have got different implications. In other words, they go back with the preamble that each sound has got an impact, you know, as numbers have got an impact. So when you say, for example, Allah, obviously you can have the translation of God, and no problem if you do not have that sense of reading that, but you just bear in mind that Allah in Arabic sense has got more opulence, has got this wealth of meaningfulness within its own concept, which may not be necessarily the same as, you know, God in English. Or when you say, for example, hello, and then you say salam, you know, salam obviously can be translated into hello or something, but if you have that sense of pragmatics, that sense of semantics of the sentence, they're not really equal in terms of the implication. In terms of perlocutionary impact, they're not going to be synonymous with one another, because it is obvious that when you say salam, somebody says hello, you know, to use just some sort of translation to help you, you know, cross the bridge or something. But if you understand the connotation, along with the denotation of salam, you understand that salam is richly opulent, is bountiful. It is so affluently embedded in multifarious layers of meaning making, in which security, for example, health, composure, equanimity, understanding, tranquility, connectedness are all quintessentially entailed in that sense. And as a result of that, once you have that sense of understanding, obviously you're going to be affected in a different way. But you can always, goes without saying, that you can always read the translation, but I would suggest, strongly suggest, that even when you read the translation, make sure that you read the Arabic one, because of the impact and because of the psychological impact that it has, plus the point that I just made in terms of the syntax and the pragmatics of the words, as it induces and provokes, thought-provoking preambles, which is going to facilitate the process of being more prepared for that sense of understanding. Otherwise, there is no problem saying or articulating in just one language or not. As you know, for example, in Qunut, in our prayer, in addition to the formal supplication and prayer that have been suggested, we can always use Persian, for example, in our Qunut, while you're in a prayer, and say whatever you want to say. So it's got no problem in that.
Thank you so much, Doctor, for your thoughtful and pertinent answer. I'm sure Habib from Sweden actually got the answer from this great answer. Actually, it's a wrap for today's news beats. So I leave the studio to Miss Yegana Faragan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Nourai. We'll be back after a short break. Okay, Mr. Fatemi, I guess all the time we have is just a minute for roundup of today's discussions on New Year's resolutions and its implications.
Well, a minute is
not.
But you can always use a minute too. Well, we just talked about the new year, the new possibility, the new developments, and the least we can say is that the new year commemorates new changes, new developments. It can be the harbinger of new possibilities for us, so we can revise our programs. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has got this beautifully framed in a hadith saying that you should have always, as a proactive believer, your today better than yesterday and tomorrow better than today. So the new year is auguring new changes, new developments, new possibilities. It can help us take it upon ourselves to look at all these new changes and new developments and get our inspirational, motivational sort of prompt to be prepared for new changes, for new developments. As I said, radical transformation of consciousness, both in heart and mind, can help us be a better, proactive person.
Okay, sure. Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to have you
in
our first New Year's program, and we look forward to having you with us in our future programs this year. Thank you so much. Well, we're approaching the end of today's program. I hope you enjoyed our discussion on New Year's resolutions, and I hope you can fulfill the resolutions you have made for this year and carry through with them. At the end of today's program, I would like to extend my condolences on the sad martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the honorable daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny. It's a sad occasion for all Muslims around the world. Thank you so much again for being with us and choosing Pure Home today. Look forward to seeing you next week, same day, same time, same hour. Thank you. Goodbye.